It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbert. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
This is an economic phenomenon. The reason this is happening is quite simple. You can make far more money off of one girl because you can sell her 1,000 times than you can make off of a kilo of cocaine, off of heroin, off of just about anything else under the sun. And that's why we have drug dealers getting into prostitution.
Charlottesville attorney Corbin Addison, author of A Walk Across the Sun, discusses efforts to shut down human trafficking for sexual servitude, the fastest growing criminal industry in the world, by heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services in the second part of a two-part presentation. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how Chesterfield County may try to limit alternative financial institutions such as payday and car title lenders. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. This show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 175, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Chesterfield County is exploring a proposed policy that could limit where alternative financial institutions, or AFIs, operate in the county. The proposal recommends that businesses such as check cashing establishments, car title lenders, and payday lenders not be located next to residential property or in areas designated for revitalization. The draft policy provides guidance for evaluating zoning applications, but the Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors still could vote to allow the business to locate in those areas. Planning Commission members took no action on the proposal at the July meeting, and the discussion will continue at the work session in August. Three zoning applications have been filed in Chesterfield County to establish car title lending businesses, one by Fast Auto Loans and two from Title Max. Currently, there are no licensed car title lenders or payday lenders in Chesterfield County, but there are 57 check cashing establishments, 8 consumer finance companies, and 2 pawnbrokers. Payday lenders have been on the decline in the state during the last 5 years. In 2011, there were 27 Virginia licensed payday lenders operating 267 offices, compared with 84 lenders operating 791 offices at the end of 2006. Chesterfield County's draft alternative financial institution policy would require these businesses to locate only in areas designated by the comprehensive plan for general commercial use, and would require a minimum distance separation of 2,000 feet between alternative financial institutions. In addition, AFIs could not be located on property next to land used, zoned, or developed for residential purposes, and could not be located in any of 6 revitalization areas, which includes portions of Chesterfield Avenue, Hopkins Road, Hall Street Road, Jefferson Davis Highway, and Midlothian Turnpike. Lastly, the proposal would require signs advertising alternative financial institutions to conform to approved sign packages within non-residential communities, such as shopping centers, and would not allow the display of neon window signs. Many of the Planning Commission members spoke unfavorably about AFIs. Dale District Commissioner William Brown said that he does not like these businesses, nor does he want to see them in Chesterfield County. Quote, "They take advantage of people when they are down and out," Brown said. "They take people who are in a hole, and instead of handing them a ladder, they hand them a shovel." With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio.
This week's legal term of the week is Medicare. Medicare is a national health insurance program run by the Social Security Administration. Part A covers some of the cost of hospitalization, extended care facilities such as nursing homes, and home health services. Part B covers some of the cost of medical expenses such as doctor's fees, outpatient treatment, and laboratory work. Part D covers some of the cost of prescription drugs. Medicare is like an insurance program and should not be confused with Medicaid, which is like a welfare program. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's legal term of the week.
Over the last decade, legislative attempts to curb human trafficking for sexual servitude have focused on victims and commercial exploiters. At the Virginia State Bar's annual conference in June 2012, Charlottesville attorney Corbin Addison, author of A Walk Across the Sun, discussed shifting the focus to heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there, and here was the second part of a two-part presentation.
So there's the portal, which facilitates the transaction, and then finally the last character in the cast is the one that gets the least amount of attention in the trafficking world. Thankfully, that's changing slowly. It's gotten the least amount of attention in Virginia law and in most laws, and that is the customer. And the more I've studied this subject, the more I realized, and everyone on the street agrees, this is an economic phenomenon. The reason this is happening is quite simple. You can make far more money off of one girl because you can sell her 1,000 times than you can make off of a kilo of cocaine, off of heroin, off of just about anything else under the sun. And that's why we have drug dealers getting into prostitution. It's not the most profitable. Drugs are still outpacing it. But it's the fastest growing criminal industry in the world for simple reason. It is unbelievably profitable, and it's so easy to make a tremendous amount of money. And there's one reason for that. And that is that there are millions of ordinary men who are on a daily basis buying sex. They're buying sex from underage girls and believing that they're overage. They're buying sex from overage girls who were trafficked as minors. They're doing this in hotel rooms across the country. Typically, actually, the girls are transported from conference to conference, sporting event to sporting event, wherever there are unattached males. And the average buyer is a guy like me or like any of us. The average buyer is not a pedophile. The average buyer is an ordinary guy, a lawyer, a policeman, a janitor, a college student, a financier. It's actually quite scary when you get down to it. So that is the nature of the trafficking phenomenon. And so you asked about Massachusetts law and the laws of Sweden. Massachusetts decided to take a different approach from Virginia, and what they did was they said, we're going to take our existing laws and across the board make the toughest anti-trafficking law we can. We're going to do this notwithstanding the fact that lots of prosecutions are happening on the federal level, and they continue to. We're going to do this because we want to make sure that our police in Boston, our police in other places in Massachusetts are adequately educated to identify trafficking victims, which is a huge problem. They adequately equipped to take down trafficking rings. They are adequately trained in the need to put buyers behind bars and penalize buyers with fines that will deter future sex buying. And we will adequately provide for social services for victims. And we will do additional things to protect victims, such as if you're a minor and you're caught prostituting, you are given an automatic stay of prosecution. So you're not going to get convicted for prostitution as a minor so long as you cooperate in the system. That's something we don't have in place. It's called a safe harbor. We don't have that in Virginia. In Virginia, you can be prosecuted through the juvenile detention system, and you can actually have those black marks on your record. So we also do not have, though they have in Massachusetts, a way to expunge prostitution convictions that were obtained against a trafficking victim. And of course, the challenge is that trafficking victims don't self-identify. They don't come to you and say, I'm a victim of trafficking. There's really a need for police, prosecutors, and social services to identify the victim and then have in place a system that allows those victims to be treated as victims, not as criminals, which they often are. Now, our federal law is very tough, and it's gotten tougher every 2 years. And I give tons of credit to the feds for their enforcement, from the FBI to the ICE, to the U.S. attorneys, to the Justice Department, and the various administrations, Democrat and Republican, that have given this subject priority. We have in this country gone after the distributor, like we've done with the war on drugs. We go after the pimps. We go after the traffickers. We go after the guys who are manipulating the girls, who are recruiting them, who are selling them. And on the federal level, that works. It works at least to the extent that we're taking down trafficking networks. There have been a lot of great stings, a lot of great cases on a discrete level. We've seen real progress, but on a macro level, we've seen this thing explode. This trade is growing at an alarming rate in this country, and everybody agrees. The FBI says it. Everybody agrees. One response is, well, we haven't adequately funded enforcement, which is true. We actually spend more on military marching bands every month than we do on the entire budget of the Trafficking Persons Office in the State Department, which is supposed to fund a lot of this stuff. So our priorities at the federal level haven't been great, but nevertheless, we've funded it okay. And the U.S. attorneys and the feds have done everything they can, but they've gone after the distributor. What the federal law doesn't do, and this is actually quite intriguing, the federal law does not criminalize the purchase of sex. That is left to the states. The solicitation of prostitution is a crime in just about every jurisdiction in the U.S., with the exception of certain counties in Nevada and in New Jersey, where there's a tremendous amount of prostitution and trafficking, because those legalization of prostitution goes hand in hand with a skyrocket in human trafficking. We've seen that in the Netherlands. We've seen that in Germany. We've seen that in Australia. Everywhere it's been tried, it's a disaster. But that's another issue. So we in this country have gone after the distributors. We've gotten successes, but what we haven't seen is any significant macro change. Sweden in 1999 said we're going to do things differently. And this was actually after a number of decades of a societal debate about women's rights and gender equality. What they decided was they reconceptualized prostitution, and they went there first. They said, okay, trafficking for sex is all about prostitution, because prostitution is what makes the money for the traffickers. But the reality is the industry, if you can call it one, of prostitution is one that victimizes women and is ultimately violence against women in most cases, not all. There are a few consenting prostitutes in the world. Most are forced either by people or by their circumstances to be doing what they're doing. So they said, we're going to reconceptualize this as violence against women. And so we in a gender equal society are not going to stand for it. And we're going to go after, we're going to take the spotlight off the women who are usually thrown in jail, given a fine, and then thrown back out on the street to be re-victimized. We're going to essentially decriminalize the sale of sex. So it's no longer a crime to be a woman prostituting in Sweden, but we are going to heavily criminalize the pimping, the trafficking, and the purchase of sex. That is, we're going to go after the men, and we're going to go after them with a vengeance. And so they did this in 1999. Now, admittedly, it took some time. Law enforcement had to wrap their minds around this because most of them are men, and they struggled to really recognize that prostitution really wasn't a victimless crime. But they started going after the buyers. And what's happened is, and this is documented with a study, after 10 years, they saw a 50% decrease in street prostitution and no significant increase in indoor prostitution. What's happened is organized crime has left Sweden. They've been going to surrounding countries. And so you see in Sweden, the number of prostituting women are down in about 100 known prostituting women that have been picked up in all of Stockholm, and 5,000 in Oslo, which is only a stone's throw away, and like 20,000 in Amsterdam, or 50,000 or something absurd, because it's legal there. So what they've done is they've said, look, we're just not going to tolerate this. And I've met people from Sweden. The cops there are amazing, and they just have this mentality, okay, this is a problem that we're going to solve by going after the money. We're going to follow the money. And if we dry up the money, we'll dry up the trade. And that's what they're seeing. Now, it's not a perfect system, and they haven't achieved some, eradication that we all dream of. But they've done something that no other country in the world has done in the past 10 years. And so what's happening in the conference I was at in Boston is there is now, right now, a national campaign to eradicate sex trafficking through abolishing demand. Massachusetts law is even tougher in some ways than Sweden, though they don't have any sort of record of enforcing it yet. So we don't know how tough they're going to be and how effective it's going to be. It's a little bit more difficult in the U.S. to enforce a Swedish model for the simple reason that our social services for women are vastly less than they are in Sweden. In Sweden, you have a very robust integrated social service system. So the women are treated as victims from the moment that they enter police custody, and there's a whole system of physical health to mental health to, you know, all sorts of different housing and relocation and various services that are available paid for by the state. So Sweden has that to offer women that, you know, states in the U.S. generally don't. We have some social services available. But Massachusetts actually did do something that I applaud them for, and that is they actually tailored their law to evidence. There are a number of great studies that came out from Harvard in the last few years about sex buyers and what it would take to deter the average sex buyer from going back to the street and buying sex. The average sex buyer, is because he's an ordinary person, actually has something to lose if he's put in jail or if his name is put in the paper or something like that. The average pimp or trafficker is a sociopath, a career criminal who, you know, you can throw them in jail, and the next thing, chances of rehabilitation are very low. So recidivism is very high. With the average John, if you will, the average customer, the studies actually show that fairly minimal punishments would be adequate to deter the average sex buyer. There was a study recently by Harvard, by some people at Harvard, of 100 sex buyers, admitted anonymous sex buyers in Boston, and 101 non-sex buyers. And it showed that 100% of the respondents would admitted that they would never go back to the street and never buy another girl if they had to spend a month in jail. A month. I mean, compare that to the, you know, the punishments that we're handing down to pimps and traffickers. In some cases, in the federal level, you're getting life. You're getting 50 years. You're getting 30 years. The amount of time and money and everything else that goes into caring for that sort of sociopath who chances are won't be rehabilitated in that period of time, you know, is just astronomical. But the average sex buyer, a month in jail, that would deter 100%. It's 80% would be deterred by having their name put in the paper, particularly if it's with a picture, for the simple reason that they're doing this under the cover of anonymity. And if they're exposed, their wives, their girlfriends, their kids, their family will know about it. Now, there's some debate about whether this is fair, and really, because there's obviously the kid that has to then find out that his father or her father's name is in the paper. But nevertheless, the statistics are there. Shaming is effective, as would be 1 month in jail. There, as far as fines are concerned, the statistics showed that a fine of between $1,000 and $2,000 per incident would deter something like 80% of buyers from going back if they were slapped with that sort of fine. 70% of buyers said that if their car was impounded, they wouldn't go back and buy again. So the truth is that effective remedies against sex buyers are minimal in comparison to what we have to do to try to get pimps and traffickers off the street. And in fact, it wouldn't in most cases require a whole long drawn out trial. You're talking about probably plea bargains in a lot of cases. And so what Massachusetts did is they followed that rubric and they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to say that for sex buying, the maximum penalty would be 2.5 years, which is a year and a half longer than Virginia's misdemeanor, class one misdemeanor for solicitation. We are also going to mandate a minimum fine of $1,000 and a maximum fine of $5,000 for every incident. They were, again, following the statistical rubric, the evidence. And so I applaud them for that. I think that that's a very good way of making laws, is basing it upon evidence. So right now in Virginia, the one law that Virginia failed to pass, and it was disappointing to me, is an amendment to our solicitation statute. In Virginia, it's a class one misdemeanor to purchase sex. A class one misdemeanor is punishable by up to 12 months in jail, but in most cases, if a guy's brought in, the most he gets is a slap on the wrist and a fine that gets turned around and put back, you know, back out on the street. There are a couple of jurisdictions recently that have opened John schools. In the right sort of context, those have been shown to be effective. In other contexts, they're a waste of time. They're like, you know, sort of when you get a traffic ticket. So, but in Virginia, we have a class one misdemeanor. The General Assembly was considering changing that to a class 6 felony if it was determined that the girl was underage, under the age of 18, and a class 5 felony if the girl was determined to be under the age of 16. That provision was scuttled in the General Assembly. It was the only one of the various provisions that was not passed in any form, which is disappointing because there are a lot of reasons to say that increasing sex buying from a misdemeanor to a felony would have a deterrent effect. There are a number of things that I encourage people to do. I mean, one is, along with highlighting the sex buyer and going after the route following the money, we have a major problem in this country, and that is that all aspects of the anti-trafficking movement, whether they are government or non-governmental, are dramatically underfunded. And this is, of course, something that, you know, we look at education. You can look at anything and say it's underfunded. This is particularly underfunded when we realize that our kids, our children, are being enslaved across the country, thousands of them. Some estimate over 100,000 minors being sex trafficked in this country. One thing that we need to do is we need to recognize this is not a Republican or a Democrat issue. This is a human issue. And to the extent that we can have the conversation about budgetary priorities, it would seem to me that the abolition of modern slavery ought to be higher up on the list in our general American list of priorities. So that's one thing. Another thing is charitable giving. I mean, my wife and I love to talk about this because it's actually, there's more money in the private sector than there is in the government as far as, you know, what would be available. There, and foundations are starting to step up to the plate, but if you have connections and charitable foundations, talk to those people about it because, you know, Gates is getting behind this. Google is getting behind this in various ways. The big foundations are starting to recognize that, hey, they could be a part of the solution. And the reality is that all of us can be. And so, you know, funding organizations that are working on a shoestring to rescue girls, to raise awareness, Polaris, IJM, there are many others, Shared Hope, that's working on the trade here in the U.S., small donations add up. So I really encourage people to be generous because we really need that. I mean, these people need the funding to do their work. In addition, as lawyers, you know, to the extent that we have the ability to increase the level, the decibel level, the conversation about trafficking in our various circles, in policy circles, in the academy, in law schools, so that young lawyers are aware of it and they can start talking about it in their circles. To the extent we can influence our own legislators here in Virginia and on the federal level. On the federal level right now, for the first time in 12 years, the federal law, the Reauthorization Act of 2011, was tabled. It was not passed. It was not passed for reasons that the fault lies on both sides of the aisle. It is not, not a partisan issue, but unfortunately it was politicized for reasons that I could talk to you about afterward. But nevertheless, we need to encourage our legislators, our congressmen, our senators, to put the abolition of modern slavery above partisan squabbles on both sides of the aisle. And that goes for Congress and the White House. So we really need to encourage that. And to the extent that we as lawyers have those connections, it's really great, you know, because our legislators are just people. They need to be aware that daughters like their own are being sold on the streets of their own city. And the fact that they might look a little different from their daughters in most cases doesn't matter. So we really need to do more. And we as lawyers have a unique voice.
You've been listening to Charlottesville attorney and author Corbin Addison discussing a shift in focus to heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services to combat human trafficking for sexual servitude. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
This week's top three tips are about Social Security. The first tip is that Social Security is a federal program that pays monthly payments to aged, blind, and disabled people, and also to dependents such as children, spouses, parents, and survivors. The Social Security Administration runs the program. The second tip is that you don't have to be low income or have low resources to get benefits. You must have worked and paid enough Social Security taxes to get benefits. The third tip is that Social Security is like an insurance program and should not be confused with Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, which is like a welfare program. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. As of July 1, 2012, evidence now can be presented by affidavit in uncontested no-fault divorce cases. Join us next week when Christy Mara, family law attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, explains how the doors of the courthouse have opened a little wider for parties seeking an uncontested no-fault divorce on the grounds of living separate and apart for the required time. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.